Blog Talk Radio.
Completely lost, he knew not who he was. This reveals to us the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip slept 20 years, that he slept through a revolution while he was peacefully snuggling up in the mountains. Revolution was taking place that everyone would change.
When he heeded certain calls, when the world
knew nothing about it, he was asleep. Yes, he slept.
There are people dying. Oh, when it's time to lend
a hand. One of the great liabilities of this life.
The greatest gift of all.
Is almost when many people find themselves.
Changing day by day,
yes,
that the world somewhere will soon make a change. We all a part of God's sacred family and the truth. You know love is all we need.
Sleeping.
We are the ones who live a brighter day. So let's
Injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor...
Dr. Martin Luther King, this is Dr. King, when I was talking to she was saying that if you ain't file your tax, get them in if they're late. They're supposed to be coming back. Make sure you file your taxes. I was trying to get her on the line where she could have something to say about taxes. The police show that I was trying to get on the line, so I'll tell you about your taxes and how to do your taxes. Tonight, we're talking about the war of the world. We're talking about peace and love. Mary, you read 23rd number Psalm Sunday, and I think I there were so many people at the Hilton, I probably didn't hear you clearly. But if you're on the line, press 1. I can see your hand up. I want you to take your time and read 23rd number Psalm today. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Press 1 on your phone, Mary, then I know that you're on. Well, where she's doing that, I'm going to talk about tonight that we're getting ready to go into May, and it's time for some of you. Okay, I see your hand up now, Mary. I'm going to put the line for you in a minute. But I really concerned about those that have been sick and those that have been having problems. In the spirit of, this is Dr. Martin Luther King, Monday night show. Now, tomorrow night, I'm going to cross over and talk to people in the spirit world. Now, what I mean, I'm going to talk to people in the spirit realm. Because I want to say this tonight. As I go to the spirit realm, I got some people, have people that died. And you want to know what's happening, why you can't get over their death. I'm going to deal with crossing over tomorrow night with the ancestors. And I'm talking to people in the spirit realm. Crossing over. I got Archangel Michael who fight all evil. And I got Jabel who is the head of the graveyard. He sees about, don't nobody come out of there without him, and can't nobody go in without him. Okay? So that's I'm going to talk a little about that tomorrow night. So have your pencil and paper where you can get it. Tonight is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. movement, a genius, a prophet, and still some of the stuff he's talking about now. But he talked about 5 years ago, still happening to us right now. Bible, and open it up and deal with what's going on. We're still living under white supremacy and racism. We deal with a country's hate. Even the guys up in Washington lie. They caught him in a lie. But he said, but they got him on tape. The camera and the tape is catching these demons that have been lying. The man shot the applicant in the head. It's on tape. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but first I'm going to have Mary read. Let me get on the line. Thank you, guys. And happy birthday to you, Regina. Happy birthday to you. Mary, you're on the line now. You read 23rd number song. And I apologize because I thought you were over with like yesterday. But I guess I probably didn't hear you. Are you on now?
Yes.
Yeah, speak a little louder. Now, what you said?
Yes.
Okay. Read 23rd number song for us.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restored my soul. He leadeth me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup running over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen.
Thank you. You completed the
time.
Sister Peaches in this city, give me a call. I was talking to Lisa about your taxes. She said if it's not coming in so long, RS is going to slow it. You're going to put the taxes in. And if some of you put the tax back, that file don't file. And right now, they all filled up and they're trying to get them out. It might be a little late. Now, if they're late with your taxes, they're going to give you, you're going to get your taxes, but you're going to get tax on some more money. They hold it out past the date. So if $500 might do $1,000, that means that's $1,500 because of their late fees, okay? So those that have to file your taxes and you look what come through, they ain't come through yet. But it's like you get that, Mr. Hawkins. Lisa, I want to thank you for giving us that information about your taxes. It's important for you to know how your taxes are going, what you need to do. She was telling me what you need to do. Because I had people call me to ask me how I put in my taxes. Some of them put them in fast, and they ain't got them. Some of them wrote it in. But right now, it all filled up. In May, your stuff will start coming in. I want to say this tonight. I was trying to get some of the brothers from the Chicago Rangers, that's on the hills riding. They said, bitch, we don't want nobody to know who we are, but we're there, and we're going to stop the crime. We don't want no grant like some people trying to do it for a grant. We're doing it to save the women and the children. I want to thank Chicago Rangers that I met with them, and they were telling me what they wanted to do. And they said, Bishop, we'll just tell you. We don't want to go to NBC, CNN. We want to do it through the grapevine. People in the grapevine know who the Chicago Rangers is. And we don't want the law enforcement to know. When we get ready to take care of the business, we're going to take care of it, then we're going to leave on. So if you find somebody handcuffed to a post or something, You know, the Chicago Rangers have been there. Okay? You got them locked up and find them tied to a post. And they got a handcuff on them. When the police come, they'll know they done did something. Okay? So I want to say, and that's good. And I support the Chicago Rangers that's going riding the L's in the train. And they just, bitch, we don't want nobody to know we undercover. And when we break out, we're going to break out. I want to thank the brother. Some of them in jail and some of them in penitentiary that thanking the brother to go and do that, to stop the killing and stop the crime and stop the killing of our black women that are going to the store and our young kids being shot on the way to school. And the Chicago Rangers is going to take care of it. Some of them is veterans. Some of them have been in Vietnam, Korea. Some of them just got out of penitentiary. And some of them is still in the pen. But when they get out, they're going to join that force. Okay? I share. I thank God for that. Now, I want to tell you tonight, as we get ready to move to the next level, I want to say this to you. We're getting ready to go to the next level. You're going to find out that some of the stuff that's been going on going to be brought out. And what I mean brought out is going to be opened up. And it's opened up with a blessing. I want you tonight, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. movement, that movement is movement for people to have jobs and to work. Sister Kim told me if you're in Detroit, they're hiring at General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. And here in Chicago, they're hiring at Ford. So if you need a job, the job's out here. And I just feel that a man have to have some type of employment to move to the next level. And stop the killing, save the babies. And I thank God for the Chicago Rangers out in full armor. And, you know, the lady called me from the president. Well, or what did I say? I can't tell you nothing, but they're out there. And you'll see the effect of the Chicago Rangers. And people have been calling me and asking me how to contact them. There, you don't need to contact them. They'll contact you. And they will come to you, and they will interview when they get ready. So that's one thing. See, sometimes we give too much information, and we defeat the purpose, okay? So look over your shoulder. It might be a Chicago Ranger there. And he ain't nothing nice. Hello. And he ain't worried about going to jail, because some of them been to jail. They've been in Vietnam, Korea. They ain't nothing nice. Look, I'm going to leave that alone. I say. But I want you to get ready for a breakthrough. I'm praying for you and you tonight. Every lover, every telephone call, those in Mississippi that call me, make sure down in Mississippi that call me after the show, because I got something to share with you and your daughter. And those that call me from Yellow City, and those that call me from Monroe, and then and Mother Francis, I want to tell you, I'm praying for you also, telling me about the feast that you're going to have in New Orleans. But I'm praying for you tonight. Get ready for a miracle breakthrough. And God will do something special for you tonight. Tonight is Dr. King Movement Night. Tonight for you to make sure that to know where you at. I was talking to some young folks today earlier. And they were saying, Bishop, I said, you are a Native American. What you mean? I'm Alpha now. You're Native American because you were here. Your ancestors have been here. So sometimes you have to drop an Alpha American because you ain't African. You are Native American because you've been here. You know, if I take 100 kids and drop off an Alpha, they're lost. You know why? Because they were born and bred here in Chicago, Detroit, California. So I want you to know you are a Native American. And Native means that this is your home. And your great-grandmother, way back there, but you're here, your mama and your daddy work here in Chicago, Detroit, California, Ohio, and you. So I just wanted to let you know that part. We're going to deal more with that. I'm still working on my book. I got one, The Myth of Jesus, but the one I'm working on, the hit to the leadership of Chicago and of America. I'm working on that book, the contract that was put out to all the leaders, and even Dr. King. It was a contract, on all the black leadership. It was a contract, and I want to let you know who wrote the contract, who put the contract out, and some of them were successful, and some of them were those that they couldn't kill, they put in prison right here in Chicago. We're going to be talking about the contract of killing the leaders of Chicago leaders. They killed some, and the rest of them, they put on a charge, and they got in prison today, as I speak today. And that's some of the stuff happened. I want you to understand that this month, you know, Abraham Lincoln got killed. Dr. King got killed in April. You know, Jesus was crucified in April. So April carried a loss of death and loss of history about life and what's going on. That's important. And do that. This is Dr. King.
When he came down 20 years later, the sign had a picture of George Washington, the first president of the United States. Rip Van Winkle looked up at the picture of George Washington, but in looking at the picture, he was amazed. He was completely lost. He knew not who he was. And this reveals to us that the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip slept 20 years, but that he slept through a revolution. While he was peacefully snoring up in the mountain, a revolution was taking place that at points would change the course of history. And Rip knew nothing about it. He was asleep. Yes, he slept through a revolution. One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitudes, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. They end up sleeping through a revolution. And there can be no gainsaying of the fact that a great revolution has taken place in the world today. In the sense it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. Then that is a revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. Then that is a human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that has taken place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place. That is still the voice crying through the vista of time, saying, behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. Now, whenever anything new comes into history, it brings with it new challenges and new opportunities. I would like to deal with the challenges that we face today as a result of this triple revolution that is taking place in the world today. First, we are challenged to develop a world perspective. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. Anyone who feels that he can live alone is sleeping through a revolution. The world in which we live is geographically one. The challenge that we face today is to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it's true that the geographical oneness of this age has come into being to a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. Our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. All of this tells us that our world is a neighborhood. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. Somehow and in some way, we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island in time itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We must see this, believe this, and live by it. If we are to remain awake through a great revolution. Secondly, we are challenged to eradicate the last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. I must say this morning that racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle, sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates, poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent for America to work passionately and unrelentingly. Get rid of the disease of racism. Something positive must be done. Everyone must share in the guilt. Individuals and as institutions. The government must certainly share the guilt. Individuals must share the guilt. Even the church must share the guilt. We must face the sad fact. 11 o'clock on Sunday morning when we stand to sing, in Christ there is no east, no west. We stand in the most segregated hour of America. The hour has come for everybody, for all institutions, the public sector and the private sector, work to get rid of racism. Now, if we're to do it, we must honestly admit certain things and get rid of certain myths that have constantly been disseminated all over our nation. One is the myth of time. There's a notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. And there are those who often sincerely say to the Negro and his allies in the white community, why don't you slow up? Stop pushing things so fast. Only time can solve the problem. If you will just be nice and patient, continue to pray, in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out. That is an answer to that myth. It is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. I'm sorry to say this morning that I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme righteous of our nation, the people on the wrong side, have used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability, comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. Without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time and realize that the time is always right to do right. Now that is another myth that still gets around. It is a kind of over-reliance on the bootstrap philosophy. There are those who still feel that if the Negro is to rise out of poverty, if the Negro is to rise out of slum conditions, if he is to rise out of discrimination and segregation, do it all by himself, and so they say, the Negro must lift himself by his own bootstraps. They never stop to realize that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. The people who say this never stop to realize that the nation made the black man's color a stigma. But beyond this, they never stop to realize the debt that they owe a people who were kept in slavery 244 years. In 1863, a Negro was told that he was free as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation being signed by Abraham Lincoln. He was not given any land to make that freedom meaningful. It was something like keeping a person in prison for a number of years and suddenly discovering that that person is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted. Just go up to him and say, now you're free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. Don't give him any money to get some clothes to put on his back or to get on his feet again in life. Every code of jurisprudence would rise up against this. Yet this is the very thing that our nation did to the black man. It simply said, you're free. And it left them there penniless, illiterate, not knowing what to do. And the irony of it all is that at the same time, the nation failed to do anything for the black man through an act of Congress. It was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, it built land grant colleges to teach them how to farm. Not only that, it provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, years unfolded, it provided low interest rates so that they could mechanize our farms. And to this day, thousands of these very persons are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies every year not to farm. And these are so often the very people who tell Negroes that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps. It's all right to tell a man to lift himself by his own bootstraps, but it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. We must come to see that the roots of racism are very deep in our country, and there must be something positive and massive in order to get rid of all of the effects of racism and the tragedies of racial injustice. Now that is another thing closely related to racism that I would like to mention as another challenge. We are challenged to rid our nation and the world of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, poverty spreads its nagging, prehensile tentacles into hamlets and villages all over our world. Two-thirds of the peoples of the world go to bed hungry at night. They are ill-housed, they are ill-nourished, they are shabbily clad. I've seen it in Latin America, I've seen it in Africa. I've seen this poverty in Asia. I remember some years ago, Mrs. King and I journeyed to that great country known as India. And I never will forget the experience. It was a marvelous experience to meet, talk with the great leaders of India, to meet and talk with and speak to thousands and thousands of people all over that vast country. These experiences will remain dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall linger. But I say to you this morning, my friends, there were those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes God's children sleeping on the sidewalks at night? In Bombay, more than a million people sleep on the sidewalks every night. In Calcutta, more than 600,000 sleep on the sidewalks every night. They have no beds to sleep in. They have no houses to go in. How can one avoid being depressed? And he discovers that out of India's population, more than 500 million people, some 480 million, make an annual income of less than $90 a year. Most of them have never seen a doctor or a dentist. As I noticed these things, something within me cried out, can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned? And an answer came, oh no, because the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation. And I started thinking of the fact that
We spend in America millions of dollars a day to store surplus.
That's food, and I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge and the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children all over the world. Go to bed hungry tonight. Maybe we spend far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. Not only do we see poverty abroad, I would remind you, in our own nation, there are about 40 million people who are poverty-stricken. I have seen them here and there. I've seen them in the ghettos of the North. I've seen them in the rural areas of the South. I've seen them in Appalachia. I've just been in the process of touring many areas of our country. And I must confess that in some situations, I have literally found myself crying. I was in Marks, Mississippi the other day, which is in Quitman County, the poorest county in the United States. I tell you, I saw hundreds of little black boys and black girls walking the streets with no shoes to wear. I saw their mothers and their fathers trying to carry on a little Head Start program, but they had no money. The federal government hadn't funded them. They were trying to carry on, and they raised a little money here and there, trying to get a little food to feed the children, trying to teach them a little something. I saw mothers and fathers who said to me not only were they unemployed, they didn't get any kind of income, no old age pension, no welfare check or anything. I said, how do you live? They said, well, we go around to the neighbors and ask them for a little something. When the berry season comes, we pick berries. When the rabbit season comes, we hunt and catch a few rabbits. And that's about it. I was in Newark in Holland just this week. And I walked in to the homes of welfare mothers. I saw them in conditions, no, not with wall-to-wall carpet, wall-to-wall rats and roaches. I stood in an apartment. This welfare mother said to me, the landlord will not repair this place. I've been here 2 years. He hadn't made a single repair. Pointed out her little boy who was a victim of lead poisoning. She pointed out the walls of all of the ceiling falling through. She showed me the holes where the rats came in. She said, night after night, we have to stay awake. Keep the rats and the roaches from getting to the children. I said, how much do you pay for this apartment? She said, $125. I looked and I thought and said to myself, it isn't worth $60. People are forced to pay more for less. Living in conditions day in and day out where the whole area is constantly drained without being replenished, it becomes a kind of domestic colony. The tragedy is so awful. These 40 million people are invisible. Because America is so affluent, so rich. Because our expressways carry us away from the ghetto, we don't see the poor. Jesus told a parable one day, and he reminded us that a man went to hell because he didn't see the poor. His name was Diabetes. He was a rich man. There was a man by the name of Lazarus who was a poor man, but not only was he poor, he was sick. Sores were all over his body.
He was so weak that he could hardly move. But he managed to get to the gate of Dives every day, wanting just to have the crumb that would fall from his table. Dives did nothing about it. The parable ends saying, Dives went to hell. There was a thick gulf now between Lazarus and Dives. That is nothing in that parable which said that Dives went to hell because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against all wealth. It is true that one day a rich young ruler came to him and he advised him to sell all. But in that instance, Jesus was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. If you will look at that parable with all of its symbolism, you will remember that a conversation took place between heaven and hell, and on the other end of that long distance call between heaven and hell was Abraham in heaven, talking to Dives in hell. Now, Abraham was a very rich man. If you go back to the Old Testament, you see that he was the richest man of his day, so it was not a rich man in hell talking with a poor man in heaven. It was a little millionaire in hell talking with a multimillionaire in heaven. Dives didn't go to hell because he was rich. Dives didn't realize that his wealth was his opportunity. It was his opportunity to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother Lazarus. Dives went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and he never really saw him. He went to hell because he allowed his brother to become invisible. Dives went to hell because he maximized the minimum. Minimized the maximum. Indeed, Dives went to hell because he sought to be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty. This can happen to America, the richest nation in the world. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America's opportunity. Help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. The question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. The real question is whether we have the will. In a few weeks, some of us are coming to Washington to see if the will is still alive or if it is alive in this nation. We're coming to Washington in a poor people's campaign. Yes, we're going to bring the tired, poor, the huddled masses. We're going to bring those who have known long years of hurt and neglect. We're going to bring those who come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. We're going to bring children and adults and old people. People who've never seen a doctor or a dentist in their lives. We're not coming to engage in any histrionic gesture. We're not coming to tab Washington.
Dr. King speaking to the other American.
Let me say that the struggle for civil rights is a struggle to make these two Americas one America. Is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. For about a decade or maybe 12 years, we've struggled all across the South in glorious struggle to get rid of legal, overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounds that system of segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodation. Public transportation was segregated. Often we had to sit in the back and within transportation within cities, we often had to stand over empty seats because sections were reserved for whites only. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. The struggle was to deal with these problems. Certainly they were difficult problems. They were humiliating conditions. By the thousands, we protested these conditions. We made it clear that it was ultimately more honorable to accept jail cell experiences than to accept segregation and humiliation. By the thousands, students and adults decided to sit in at segregated lunch counters to protest conditions there. When they were sitting at those lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream, seeking to take the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. 1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being after the Birmingham Movement, which did a great deal to subpoena the conscience of a large segment of the nation to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. After the Selma movement in 1965, we were able to get a voting rights bill. All of these things represented strides. But we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good, solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine quality integrated education a reality. So today we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. Not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. And I'm convinced that many of our people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I came to see this in a very difficult and painful way in Chicago over the last year where I've lived and worked. Some of the people who came quickly to march with us in Selma and Birmingham were active around Chicago. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we've got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. So as a result of all of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked. But Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. So the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than white. As we look at these problems, we see them growing and developing every day. We see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate, the nation as a whole, is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes it's about 8.4%. But these are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs, and so they can be calculated. The statistics can be gotten because they are still somehow in the labor market. But there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope. They've come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor for them with no exit sign. And so they no longer go to look for a job. There are those who would estimate that these persons who are called the discouraged persons would be 6 or 7% in the Negro community. That means among Negroes may well be 16%. Among Negro youth in some of our large urban areas, it goes to 30 and 40%. So you can see what I mean when I say that in the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now the other thing that we've got to come to see now that many of us well during the last 10 years, that is that racism is still alive in American society and much more widespread than we realize. We must see racism for what it is. It is the myth of the superior and the inferior race. It is the false and tragic notion that one particular group, one particular race is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insight, and the total flow of history. And the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved, innately inferior. In the final analysis, racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. Hitler was a sick and tragic man who carried racism to its logical conclusion. He ended up leading a nation to the point of killing about 6 million Jews. This is the tragedy of racism because its ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I am not good enough to live next door to him, if one says that I am not good enough to eat at a lunch counter, or to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him, merely because of my race, he is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. To use a philosophical analogy here, racism is not based on some empirical generalization. It is based rather on an ontological affirmation. It is not the assertion that certain people are behind culturally or otherwise because of environmental conditions. It is the affirmation that the very being of a people is inferior. This is the great tragedy of it. I say that however unpleasant it is, we must honestly see and admit that racism is still deeply rooted all over America, still deeply rooted in the North, still deeply rooted in the South. Now this leads me to say something about another discussion that we hear a great deal, and that is the so-called white backlash. I would like to honestly say to you that the white backlash is merely a new name for an old phenomenon, not something that just came into being because shouts of black power or because Negroes engaged in riots and what, for instance. The fact is that the state of California voted a fair housing bill out of existence before anybody shouted black power or before anybody rioted and watched. May well be that shouts of black power and riots and watts in the Harlems and the other areas are the consequences of the white backlash rather than the cause of them. What it is necessary to see is that there has never been a single solid monistic determined commitment on the part of the vast majority of white Americans. The whole question of civil rights and on the whole question of racial equality. This is something that truth impels all men of goodwill to admit. It is said on the Statue of Liberty that America is the home of exile.